Today on Talk About That, we celebrate our 200th show by welcoming in special guests Dave Barnes and John McLaughlin from the Dadville Podcast. Together we spent an hour talking about old songs, creativity, legacy, and weed eating as an art form. Today's episode is not sponsored by cats. If you own one, you also own a box of poop. Let's go.
Hey guys, it's your favorite part of Monday. It's Talk About That. I'm John here with my buddy Johnny. What's up, man?
Hello, friends.
It's great to have you guys along today. Johnny, that was quite like that? The welcome.
Gosh. Yeah. That was the most Monday.
I was going fireside chat. Well, listen.
Hello, friends.
First of all, I'm in like a nondescript government building in my shot. You guys all have instruments and things behind
you. I was going to say,
I'm just like, if you can get help to me somehow.
I was going
to
say, not if you're in trouble.
It's just like, yeah. I was trying to get the lamp in the shot.
Me well. They give
it's
me
like
food.
A glow. It still feels like.
That looks like a cool lamp.
It's not. It is
still very industrial, though.
It does. Okay, I'm sorry.
You're either in a prison or at like a new Urban Outfitters somewhere.
Which some would call the
You're not going to believe these deal I got on these jeggings.
I don't know if there's a place. My dilemma, I know this is where I wanted to go with this, so I'm just going to take it straight. Sure. My dilemma with Urban Outfitter, I literally thought one time, I was like, their music programming sounds like, let's get 16-year-olds to send in their demos, only if they've never played music or written a song before.
Right. Yeah.
Every time I've walked through, I haven't been in years since COVID, but it was just like, I can't, there's a world where somebody decided this was the music to play in here.
And maybe it is demos though. I mean, this is Nashville. So it could be, this just like, hey,
just put on like, hey, maybe we'll get some cuts.
My complaint with Urban Outfitters is whenever I'm in there, I cannot tell who works there.
I think that's what they want.
Everyone and no one is helpful.
Okay,
so it's kind of annoyed that I'm there and I just need help and no I go up to someone, they're like, I don't work here.
How many dilemmas do you have?
There's
to
a
have?
Lot of we have a lot right. of problems with our not a sponsor today.
You know,
not a sponsor.
You know a weird superpower one of my best friends has is he for a long time his sort of weird superpower was that no matter what men's clothing store he was in, people always thought he worked there. Huh. And I saw this happen, and I'm not being facetious, double digits amount of times. I would be with him. And so I'd be like, hey, sir, I'm so sorry. And he's like, oh, I don't work here. And then he just stopped. Well, he just stopped. He's like, let's go find it. And he'd be like, I'm just tired of saying no.
Holler if you need anything else. That's a 36. I mean, if you need a 38, we can crank you back up.
Yeah, that happens to me at Walmart. I don't know what that says.
Yeah, that's
like, same for me at Jiffy Lube.
Like, I just whatever, man. I put on some Hooters for the guy.
Honestly,
I'm trying to help.
Hooters happened last
Hooters
week.
Just trying to help.
I was there ministering. By here's the judge.
Here's the deal, though. You got. I don't know how old you guys are, but I grew up in the era of like DJs, Chess King, in the malls, and there was a store called Merry Go Round. When I was a kid, you go in, and one side of the wall was men's clothes, and one side was women's clothes. But everything's like rayon and shirts or blousey.
Flammable.
Even on men,
they're
very like go up like flash paper if a spark hits. And so I'm on one side. I'm like, I like this purple shirt. I'm gonna go, and then I realize this is a woman's. I'm holding a blouse.
Yeah.
I'm on the wrong side of the store. I've wandered over. Yeah. I'm holding a sequined belt.
Yeah, that era where everybody was wearing like very loud, like rayon, silky kind of shirts.
Hammer
pants.
They
were all very big. That was a very androgynous time.
It was.
If you were trying to pick out a button-down silk or rayon shirt, all of them were fair game.
Yeah.
Right? Remember it was a very Z-Cav color? Richie time. I mean,
the
Living
Z-Cav.
Color was.
That was what everyone was wearing.
It was. Jim Carrey cut his teeth on purple rayon. He really did.
Literally. Yeah. I think maybe.
Probably could have. We didn't introduce our guest, John. We just rolled right into it.
Yeah. Listen, guys,
you're dealing with professional podcasters, okay? Yeah,
we're going to jump in and just, right in the
We hit the hard issues, didn't we? Went straight to it.
Yes.
Yeah, I think we got what we need. You guys need a couple of outros and then we're done?
Yeah. Let's treat a couple of ads and get out of here. Stamps.com, everybody.
Guys,
no, we're not.
Oh, that's good.
We used
good.
To go to the post office once every 2 months, and now.
Yeah,
no.
And now.
Hey, you remember the post office? Your grandmom does.
Yeah. Hey, we do want to welcome our special guest today. It is Mr. Dave Barnes and Mr. John McLaughlin. Thank you guys so much for joining us today.
Oh, Pleasure
happy
to be
that
here.
Was it. Okay.
We're just following Johnny.
Are y'all on our podcast or are we on y'all's?
You ask us anything you want to know.
Okay. Can I actually ask you a question? I'm being sick. Can I ask you? Okay. John asked me this question. John, I need to give you credit for how many times I've asked people this in the last week, because I think this is one of the best questions I've ever been asked in my life. So we were doing like a one-off, just the two of us, for Dadville. And John had prepped the questions, which was so amazing because John is like one of the best question asker in the history of time. And he said, and I can't laugh without it, I've thought about this question so much and I'm posing it to y'all.
Okay.
What is the one thing that you are irrationally confident about? How great is that question? Yeah, I've thought about that question so much.
That's a good one.
Isn't it great? Let me
you know
give you.
What's funny is that since I've asked you that, Dave, since I had that question, I have thought like, all right, well, is there anything that I'm rationally confident in?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No,
all the things I'm confident in are like, yeah, there's, well, I have no there's no for being, yeah, confident, yeah,
yeah.
In that.
I was talking to one of our really good friends, one of our friends who's a mom, and I asked her that, and she's like, and she, without batting an eye, she's like, how many kids I can fit in the van? And I was like, this is exactly the answer.
Oh yeah, I've got one of those. Yeah, I've got something like that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, because yeah, at first when you hear it, you're kind of like, I don't know, and then it is one of my favorite questions I've ever heard in my life. I think about it, and I love asking people because it elicits some really amazing responses.
Mine's gonna be really weird, but Johnny, you go first.
Well, I think when you said that about kids in the van, I think when we used to be in John and I were in a band together, and I think I was the packer. I knew, like, all right, there's all this crap out on the thing.
And but you gotta have
it will
that
fit.
Guy.
They're going, there's no way this all fits. I go, I don't think you understand.
Yeah.
You're dealing, I think, with... I got this. I play a little Tetris and I know what I'm doing here. Yeah. And it would always fit. And then we'd have to take it all out because the van drank oil, and we'd have to. And it was one of those vans where the engine was under the seat.
Under the seat.
Remember the old Toyota vans?
Oh, dude, do
so
I?
So we'd have to take all the gear out and flip the seat back to put
oil
in it.
You sat on that thing too long as a kid, and your rear.
You
was
get
on
grill marks for sure. Oh. Yeah, it's no good. No good. But so, yeah, so for sure, I was the packer. I knew how to, like, fit everything. I could look at like a heap of junk and be like, "This will all fit, and we're gonna get to Tulsa." Because I've got 4 quarts of oil in tow.
Tulsa.
Got to stop.
It's always Tulsa.
It's always Tulsa. Why is it always Tulsa?
We use more oil than gas. In that
we did.
Oh, God, those days, man.
What about you, John?
Yeah, well, so this is weird. It's really weird. But so I was raised doing commercial lawn care.
Okay.
And, like, I am irrationally confident about my ability to weed eat.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I John's, love this. Oh,
yeah. John talks trash about weed eating like no other.
Like, I can hear people outside, and my wife laughs.
You can hear whether they're doing it wrong? Like, that guy.
No, I can tell about the RPMs of the small engine. I'm like,
What are you doing?
Are you serious?
No. Oh, yeah.
You can hear RPMs?
Are you constantly seeing, like, trim along yards and being like, oh, they botched this guy over there?
Yeah, it's like rookies, amateurs.
You call that edging? Get out of here.
Yeah. And it's very, like guys, in my heyday, like, I could take a single petal off a flower with a weed eater. Like, it is super sad.
Is it like snatching the pebble from the hand? It's like a.
This is one of the
was
best
it one of those where, like, the string
I've
is, like,
life.
Huge? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, John used the handlebar one, too. Like, the weed eater with the handlebars off to the side so you can get the sway going.
We had this, like, okay, this is getting really nerdy, but we had, like, this. I had, like a 42 cc engine. Like, my dad, we had these huge, because it's apartment complexes and stuff. Right. So, big engine. And yeah, I had the handlebars and the heads on this thing. I can make like almost a 2-foot swath.
Yeah. You can do almost as much as the mower. I've seen you walk behind a mower and do almost as much as the mower is doing.
There were times when my mower at my last house, my mower was so old I didn't want to start it. I would just weed eat the yard. Just take it, and I can do it faster. Yeah.
And so, listen, I think the quote maybe of the week, if not the month for me, is I could take a single leap off.
I don't want to brag, guys, but you see that? Hey, he loves me. He loves me not. How about that? How about that right now?
Listen, I just want to say, like, if that kind of confidence, one, but two, I really envy that. Like, I take a lot of pride. Like, me and John love our yards. Oh, it's one of the things we really love. And man, when I've given it a good, like edging, the
edging
power,
is
like,
everything.
But I tell you what, man, everything. I'll drive by these commercial landscapers and they're cutting yards, and those guys who know how to use a weed eater, it is a beautiful thing to watch. Like, they flip it, they do the side, they go, and it's just like, ugh. And I tell you what's even crazier. I found there's this huge trend on TikTok and Instagram where people will, like, lawn care guys that are good at edging will just, they'll do a yard and they'll get millions of watches because it's so therapeutic for people.
Interesting.
Like, this is a real thing.
John,
like, people will watch a guy.
This is how you go viral, buddy.
Honey, what have I been doing this whole time?
Well, and you can share the gospel while you do it too, Jay. You can be quoting
TikTok is
like yelling
guys,
over the motor.
How do we get more middle-aged dads to get on TikTok?
The grass fades, and so do we, my friends.
Here,
and
it,
you just go into
there
it.
There it is. But like, there's an account that, like, it's just a guy pressure washing professionally, and I was it got me both of those accounts. Yeah. I was like, this is ridiculous. Next, this is the dump. Yes. Next, why am I what next? Like. It's
just like our
now life. The algorithm has you and you're the pressure wash guy.
It's toast.
That's all they ever
Which
send
I'm like,
you.
Man, if it's going to have me, that's a very safe algorithm to get
started. That's true. 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 No chance of that going R-rated on you. It's weird.
I'm going to tell you, you watch one video with Jabba the Hutt and all of a sudden you're just getting a bunch of Carrie Fisher in bikinis. That's just, how that goes.
Yeah, that's
folks.
Not what I asked for.
That's not what I came here for, but that's what I'm getting, you know?
Oh, that's great.
We're good. I think that's it, guys.
That's okay. let's
we talked about that.
Can we get the next guest in?
We gotta have covered everything by now.
Well, hey guys, we're just excited to have you today because they're musicians, songwriters, hosts of an incredible podcast called Dadville. And that's where I got to meet you guys, actually, because you graciously interviewed me and my co-author, Reggie Dabbs, on our book about racism in America, and kind of thought you were jerks. But I thought I was going to give him a second chance. Like, you know, let's see, maybe we can connect again and right all the wrongs from that one. So actually,
it's
really
a lot of posturing.
It was.
I wasn't invited on. I know I'm not a dad, but I wasn't invited on at all, which hurt my feelings. I had to go on Dadaville, which is a philosophy podcast. And, bro, it is dark on there. They just go down the rabbit hole.
We are fighting with them on domain names.
Don't you think you should?
Left and right.
It's okay.
Their emails are
so Dave,
long.
I got a Dave Barnes story because I saw you open for Johnny Lang maybe 15 years ago?
Yes, yes.
At a theater in Atlanta?
Yes.
And a buddy of mine who's John's brother-in-law was super into you. Oh, my gosh, he was the opener? Oh, my gosh, he's amazing. I was like, yeah, he was really great. And then I moved to Nashville in 2007, and by then you had a few records out and were doing well, and you were even on radio some. And then somebody told me, hey, you know, Dave Barnes is doing stand-up now. And I've been doing stand-up like a year and a half, 2 years, so 8 times. And because that's how your first year of stand-up goes. But I was like, what? No way. Because I knew that you were like funny between songs and stuff and that you had like a good rapport and everything.
Can that just be a descriptor of me in general? It's just funny between songs.
Funny between songs. That's the name,
that
should be the name of your stand-up
record.
But I was almost like, what is this guy doing? Come on, man. So I went down to the Bell Court where you did you remember this?
Yes.
So I go down to the show and I got to tell you, my friends all wanted to go. And I was furious because you were really funny. And I've never really.
I don't know.
Really,
was that? Do you remember if that was the first time I did that or the second time?
I think it was the first. It was a Christmas time thing.
Bro, I have never in my life. I told somebody yesterday. I was talking to some friends about this because they were asking about it. The first time I ever did legit. And one, I think my set was like an hour and 15 minutes, which is just obscene. Like, what am I doing with my life?
Yeah, I was like, this is self-indulgent.
Well, I just didn't know.
That bothered
me.
No.
Well, here's the truth, though, Johnny. I did that because I thought of it like music. I'm like, hey, people paid this money. You got to give them a full show.
Right,
I didn't realize that that's not how it works. But my manager, one of my managers walked downstairs and we still laugh about this to this day. And she said, I turned the corner and you were so terrified. Like, I've never seen you before or since be so scared. Like, I was absolutely like whitewashed.
Well, it's a different element, right? You're a different.
I've never in my life been that scared before or
this
after.
Is right before you were about to go out on stage?
Like, because it was like a sold out show at the Bell Court, my first legit stand-up show, and it was packed, and I was like, what am I doing? what am
I doing? To me, the thing about stand-up comedy, which I've never done before, but I mean, when I'm on stage, we're actually just interviewing Michael W. Smith and talking to him about, you know, what is it about a show that you need? Like, mm-hmm. is there anything when you get on stage, what are the things that you need to feel like the show is going well? And for me, I need to make the audience laugh. Like once I make them laugh, then my shoulders drop. It's like hitting, like, you know, scoring a basket in basketball. It's like once you get that first shot,
see the ball go through the hoop, you're good.
There we go. Yeah.
And that's how the basketball guys talk about it, John. That exact terminology.
Once you tell he's in it. In the hoop,
you score. The
basketball players say the same thing. They say, listen, if we don't score any points, but we made the audience laugh, guys, we're going places.
Harlem Globetrotters.
And that's why the Lakers are terrible this year.
Right. Yeah, they're taking that off.
Thank you for coming out, folks.
No, but with stand-up comedy, it's like there is nothing to like bail out to.
Right.
Like I'm going to try to make the audience laugh, but mm-hmm. I can dive into a song.
You can pivot. Yeah.
Yeah. There is no pivoting. It's just you and a microphone and terror.
I wouldn't say that I'm more comfortable than I ever have been. I've been doing it full time since 2012 and I started in 2008, but it's like, I remember, when you first start, it's terrifying. And the real reason is because I've been in bands with John and you have each other to lean on. You're like, all right, I'm having an off night. John's got me on these harmonies though, or this song is good enough to get me out of the hole that I'm in.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
But with your jokes, it's like you're completely alone and you're totally exposed.
Yeah.
And if they don't like it, they don't like you.
Yeah.
It's you that they don't like.
Oh, yeah. There's nowhere to point that.
So it is a very different vibe.
Well, you know, the thing that I learned that night, literally at that show, was, oh boy, I didn't think they would laugh here, and I've still got a minute left of this story.
Mm. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, that was a very, that
having
happened
to top
probably
the laugh,
10 times.
It's in the middle.
Yes. Yeah. That happened 10 times that night. I was like, oh, I didn't think about the fact that that could be funnier than where I'm going with this. And then you're like, well, anyway, she met her husband, fell in love. So the next story I want to tell you, you know, everybody's kind of like, well, that was a huge lesson. The other thing that I like, to John's point, McLaughlin, all of you are Johns, and we all are in our own ways, but, you know, is that there is, like, I remember watching the Seinfeld documentary, stand-up or comedian. And, realizing, like, you know, Sting can walk, we talked about this, we had Bargatze on and we were laughing about this, but like, I was laughing about this and I was talking about how Sting can walk into a club with a song and say, hey, can I play you guys this, you know, what Seinfeld does in that show where he comes, you know, walks onto Caroline's or wherever, like the show's done. Then, hey, Seinfeld, do you want to hear him do 5 minutes? And, you know, but if Sting does that, comes in with his guitar and the song can be terrible. It can literally be like, it could sound like the Barney theme song, but because it's Sting's voice and it's his guitar and it's his aura, it's still it's redemptive. You're like, it's still Sting and his voice. The song was terrible. God, just hearing his voice, hearing his guitar playing, it just affects him. Seinfeld goes in and bombs. People are just mad. There's nothing redemptive about comedy that's not funny. And I think like that's what's so intimidating is you realize with John and I, you know, and you guys, when you were touring the world, especially Tulsa, the local Tulsa area,
huge.
You know, you can have a bad night, but there's something people are going to like, it's not just bad. You know what I mean? Like they loved one song or you all nailed the harmonies. You know, there's something that kind of everybody's like, but that, you know, comedy, man, if it's not funny, people are not just not entertained. They're angry. You know what I mean? Like people don't, it's rare you leave a music show where you're like pissed. Like every now and then, if it's really bad or the guy is a diva or, you know, like,
or if Axl Rose started a riot in St. Louis.
You know, like they don't play all their hits or whatever. You're going to leave pretty mad, but I don't think it's a very common thing. You leave music shows like mad, you know, but boy, you can leave stand-up shows mad. Like you can be like, that was a waste of money or he just wasn't funny or whatever.
Well, I thought it was great, and it did. It made me kind of mad because I was like, "Here's this guy that can do all this stuff," and I didn't like it. It made me upset. I don't want to say I was rooting. I don't want to say I was rooting against you, but I don't think I need to say it.
You wanted me dead.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to say it. It was
assumed. No, it's great, and now you've gone on to do it. You did a stand-up record this past year, correct?
Yeah, it was fun.
Was it during the pandemic that you recorded it?
No, we actually did it before. It got recorded.
Caused the pandemic.
Because, in a lot of ways, yes. because of, and it caused.
It caused, the, it caused the pandemic. It was the, but patient we had, zero was the original title.
Yeah. You know, what's weird is my wife, I think, was literally patient 12 in Nashville.
Oh, really?
No joke. Yeah. She was at an event where like 50 people got it before anybody even knew what it was.
Yeah.
We recorded it. My manager and a genius, my old manager, who's still a dear friend of mine, and a genius move was like, hey, I did a show at the City Winery. I don't know. This was like 2019 or something. Mm-hmm. He was just like, just so you have it, just for posterity, for remembering the jokes, you know, because I don't do it enough that I would just forget sort of cadence, right, and all, you know, probably everybody does if you don't do something well. But, and I always just thought it was really funny. Like, I'd reference it if I was doing a show and remember how I told jokes. And I was finally like, I think this is good enough to put out. And so my new management, I sat with them about it and they were like, yeah. And so we released it. But it's actually been, it's probably, you know, 3 years old now. But it's, man, it's just taken, everybody's listening to it. It's everywhere. I can't get away from it.
Yeah.
Now people are just yelling the stand-up jokes at my shows. It's not, and these are music shows, mm-hmm, you know, yeah, which that gets really awkward.
That's what happens to Chappelle, right? I'm Rick James.
That's what
they just
do.
Shout out Rick James at him the whole time.
Oh God. Yeah.
Brutal.
Imagine? When
that's a whole other level of fame where you're like, this is now annoying again. I don't want to get there. I just want to stay under the radar, guys. And I think I'm on my way. I think I can do it. John played me some of your music. Other John. And it's super enjoyable. I like your songs.
Hey, thank you.
I follow you. I think I follow you on social media, but he played like a couple of tracks when we were setting up for the interview, and I was like, this is great.
Yeah,
he's, you know, I've, so much I have done show. This long enough that yeah. when someone says something that open-ended, like, oh, we listened to some of your stuff, I'm yeah. like, oof. I mean, that could be good or bad. I don't know.
That's hard, right? Does you guys ever have that where you say you have an old song that you're like, are tired of playing, but it's somebody's favorite tune and you're like, oh no. And you don't, you don't want to like tell that person you're stupid for liking that. I've moved way past that creatively. Yeah.
Well, there was actually a song on my first, I mean like in quotes, my first like major label record called Indiana. I did a 10-year anniversary tour of it where I played the whole record front to back. And there was a song on there that I had refused to play. Like, I did not want it to go on my record.
Yeah.
I hated this song immediately after we were done writing it. And so I like took a stance on it that lasted so long that I'd never, like, I forgot what my problem was with the song.
Oh, that's good.
Literally.
Yeah. Forgot why you hated the song. I think that's why a lot of people stay married. They're just like, I forgot why I didn't like you. And so let's stick it out.
I guess we're good now. We weathered the storm. No, like the first night of the, so this tour that I did was all solo and then we ended with an orchestra. But so all these shows were solo. And you know, like I didn't rehearse this song because I hate this song, but I know it enough to play it. So I get there, I'm on stage in Seattle and I'm like, okay, track three, here we go. I got to play this song. And I sort of like in real time am playing the song and listening to it and be like, what was it that I didn't like about this song? I cannot remember.
Like floating above yourself.
Yeah.
Trying to find objections with your own content.
And as we go through and I end the song, I'm like, I kind of like this song. I literally don't know what the problem was.
You fell in love with it all over again.
But all the while, like those 10 years when people would be like, oh my gosh, one of your songs means so much to me. And the whole time that they're talking, I'm like, please don't say, just give it time. Don't say. And then it's just give it time.
Yeah.
Will you play it?
We played it at our wedding. And yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, no, that doesn't even make sense that you played it at your wedding.
It doesn't.
It's a terrible. Yeah. So.
No, that's interesting. I think we used to be that way. We put out like three different projects and there would be somebody that would want something from our first project. And we'd be like, no, we're not doing that.
Yeah, we won't do
it. And I think I read a thing about, I read on our interview with Paul Simon and he said he used to be that way about early stuff with Simon and Garfunkel. And he said, I had to realize that like when you put out something, it's a dialogue. It's not a monologue. So like their response is a part of the process.
Wow.
And so he goes, it was so prideful to say that to somebody.
Right.
And, you know, because it's like you're chipping away at something that was a touchstone for their childhood in some cases.
Totally.
And for no reason. He's just like, why am I doing this? So he stopped doing that. So it's interesting. Yeah.
I feel completely different about it now, even with I mean, there are definitely songs that I don't love and don't necessarily want to play, but I don't have that kind of like, you know, dig in my heels, like principled, like I will not play this song. I mean, I don't feel that way at all anymore.
Well, I mean, you're a seasoned artist too, because I mean, that would mean you also understand you're not, everything's not rising and falling on one piece of your art.
Exactly.
I think that's something, you know, I have to remind myself, whether it's a book or something. In fact, my pastor friend will tell me, he's like, hey, no matter how you feel, you know, this is not your one shot. Like this is not the one thing that's going to define you. So it may feel big in the moment or may feel small in the moment, but it's going to be a whole lot of collective things that come together to make a cumulative part of your life. And art's just one part of that. So I think, yeah, over time.
That's huge to know. Cause now I know that cumulatively I'm a failure. It's a tapestry of a lot of little failures that made up.
Yeah. It's not just the one, Johnny.
No,
you're forgetting many others.
Yeah. Well, but you know, y'all said this well, because the truth is, at the time, like John McLaughlin, because I felt this when I was making my first record, you know, to your point, you know, John Driver, this is getting confusing, but
we need name placards below.
Yeah, I know. But you know, like you just said, it's not the, you know, when you're in the beginning of your career, those things are the only things you've done. So there's not a cumulative, there's only these 12 windows into who John McLaughlin is, or me, or whoever. So at the time, it's paramount. Like, you feel this at a very egregious level. It's like, of the 12 things I'm sending out into space, I don't like one of them. You know, then you fast forward to 10 albums, 8 albums in, suddenly you're like, oh yeah, that, you know, I think you start to your point, you know, you kind of go like, oh no, there's been a lot and I feel more established in my career. So that moment then that felt paramount is, you know, you can almost revisit these moments and go, God, well, to your point, John, it's like, why was that? Why did I not like this? Because at the time there was context for it, I'm sure. Like, you knew. Well,
and it's like, that is true, like on the outward facing side of it, you know, like what you're putting out into the world. It's like, if one of those 10 songs, that's 10% of your catalog.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
But now, but also what's happening is, like, just personally, like, back during that time when I had that beef with that song, it's like, what was the rest of my day consisting of? Mostly, like, I'm focused on my career. I'm writing, I'm rehearsing with the band, we're touring all the time. Now it's like my life has so much more, I feel like, depth, you know, now that it's, you know, first and foremost is like having kids and being married and all of that kind of stuff. It's like, it is, even internally, it's like such a small piece of the pie.
Yeah.
And it's like, when you, to me, it's like golf too. It's like, you have one good shot in a golf game and it's like, I could get good at this.
Right.
So it's like, if you have one successful thing, it gives you a little bit of courage to take the next big risk. Cause like, we talked about that one time on our show about like, not taking a risk is the biggest risk. So like, if you stop taking risks as an artist, you're dead. You're already dead. So it's like, you have to figure out a way to trick yourself to not just atrophy creatively.
Well, you know, too, I mean, follow me as we spelunk. This is me, a deep dive. That was two metaphors.
Here we go.
The more I think about this and the older I get, I'm 93 now.
Wow.
I've had a lot of work done. I do feel like something that is an important thing for creatives to remember is, we're also trying to work toward a body of work. Right. You know, it's not just about these single moments. And yes, it is. I mean, like an album release or a show, or, you know, like a stand-up show or a book. Like, you know, in the moment, it is about those things. You want to promote them. You want to see them mass disseminated, or as much as your hope for it is, at least. But I think the thing that's hard to remember while you're creating is that there's going to be a day where you look backwards and there's all this stuff you've created. And it's this really exciting thing to me to think, you know, it justifies that moment, you know, when you go, oh yeah, just give it time. And the context of 100 songs is actually pretty cool to think about, you know, where when it was in the context of 12, it bummed me out. But I think that's the thing that I think a lot about as I'm getting older and have done this for 20 years now. It's like, I just love thinking at some point there's going to be all this music I've made that I want to be able to celebrate collectively, like the body of it, just that. And I think sometimes the minutia of that stuff can get us so, you know, tricked out. Like I've been doing, John and I've been talking a lot about this, but I've been doing this deep dive on the Beatles and Paul McCartney. And it's so fun. Like I've just taken the last month to just one, listen to all the Beatles records, but I'm slowly going through all his solo stuff too. And it's just cool to see all this work he's made and to listen to it that way, not critically go in going, what is every song I like? Or like, what are the songs I hate? And I don't, but just going, I just want to sort of get a feel for the whole thing and work my way through it in a way that's like, wow, you can feel the ebbs and flows and things he was interested in. Some stuff that wasn't quite as cool as some stuff that was, but it's just cool to see it as a whole and take it in that way and not so moment to moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, for all of us, assuming, you know, and even now, even if, you know, something happened to us today and we didn't see tomorrow, you still have all the stuff you've done, but man, you had another 20 or 30 years to each of our lives. That's a lot more stuff that we've done. So it's fun to me to kind of think in those moments where I can get a little too critical.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, hold on, man. Like, you know, it's also about the, just the body of it, just the whole of it, you know, that you've put out this stuff into the world that, you know, when you take a 30,000 foot view, it's pretty amazing. Like you did all this stuff and it represents all these emotions. And
I want to have like a vault, like Prince has, where there's so much stuff. And then like, there's like an award of the state that has to come in and be like, we now are going to give you this Nothing Compares to You demo from 1982.
Yes.
You know, like he does. They, this is now, it's like they unseal it or something. It's like, it's a classified document from Nixon. And they go, you're allowed to see this now. It's not redacted anymore. And you go, oh, that was pretty good. It's pretty funny.
Well, that's, you know, out. McCartney put out, some of what set me on is he put out this lyrics book, in December, and my wife gave it to him for Christmas. But one of the reasons that he did it, because it's all, it's like all these old pictures, and he sat down with this Pulitzer Prize winning author who helped him kind of write the thing too and put it together, because every single lyric has a story with it. So, you know, Blackbird to even his own stuff. But what happened is he sat down with his staff and like basically commissioned them to go to these two or three places he had all of his memorabilia, like just his life of collecting things. And there was a million pieces of, there were just a million items between these like storage sheds or his houses or whatever. And they just over, I think a year or two, just slowly kind of like parsed them out. And then he would go look at them and sort of go, oh, you know, like he found he thought he lost the lyric to the first song he ever wrote, and he found it, you know, when he was like 13. So just, you know, to your point, it's like, you sort of look back and go, golly, I've done all this stuff. And there's all these little Ebenezer moments of my life where, you know, that are crazy to think that, you know, if we all get to keep doing this like we are, that someday that'll be a thing. You kind of go back and go, God, I didn't even remember that song. You
know? See, it's gotta be hard for songwriters, because I think about historically the nature of modern pop music, meaning you have to nail your thought in a 3 to 5 minute, you know, amount of time, as opposed to throughout history, how music was written more in scores, symphonies, and you had a chance to do a longer something with greater movement.
Will it down to the ADD minds of the 80s, 90s, and aughts.
Yes, yeah, it really is. And it keeps like, getting
get to the point. What's the Tom Petty, Don't Bore Us, Get to the Chorus?
Oh, yeah.
Right. And I even think about, like Johnny and I talk about this sometimes, I even think about in the last 20 years, there was a day in my life where you only bought whole records, which means you at least gave the artist a chance to give you 12 songs.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, it's only if it's someone that you're, you know, you can stream the whole record, but usually it's all about the single now, which means you get fewer and fewer like chances and shots to really affect someone with whatever your message is. And so the pressure, to your point, if you want to have this grand, you know, sort of collection of things to look back on, it's got to be hard. Music seems like getting harder and harder to do that, because man, you get these one little shots is how it feels. So that's a really interesting thought. That's why I like, again, long form writing, just because at least you're going to get a chance. I mean, people don't read books. I mean, there's a whole thing about people not reading books, which is okay. But you know, you do
it's
get a chance.
It's not okay, John. We're going to stamp out illiteracy today on the show. No, John and I always talk about on our show, and maybe you guys can speak into this, but like our job, we're so close, but our jobs are similar, but then like they're polar opposites in one way. And that is, it's John's job to take like someone's thought and be really verbose about it and stretch it to 50,000 words. And it's my job to take some like big thought and get it to the least amount of words and still get a laugh. And so we have to like, we have like opposite ends that we work from.
Both are noble pursuits.
I really appreciate you saying that. I was searching for that.
One's obviously better than the other, but
So you're saying I shouldn't quit. Thank you.
Yeah, one is just pernicious skullduggery. And so I don't know.
Pernicious skullduggery. Pretty sure he was a wide receiver for Alabama last year.
He was. That guy's good. That guy's good.
So fast.
He was a 3-star. Should have been a 4-star.
Yeah, I know.
I feel like, though, with those two pursuits, I mean, there are just keeping it within music and my mm-hmm. own world and Dave and I's world, you know, like Tom Petty is maybe the best example of like saying the most with the least.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like she grew up in an Indiana town, had a good looking mama who never was around. Like that is always the example that I think of where
yeah,
I'm
it's
like,
perfect.
He
perfect.
Said Can't. So yeah. much in that yeah, one yeah, line. Yeah. And it's like the music is so simple. And maybe if at a glance, it seems like very simple, like, oh, well, you could whip that out. Like someone at Juilliard could be like, I could write a song like that, but then you try it out, and it is really a skill. Like it is something that
yeah,
is
even take the some time. That whole band, even the guitar parts. It's like it's not that they're impressive; it's that it's the right notes. It's the right.
Yeah, hook. There's nothing in there that doesn't play a role. There's yeah. nothing that doesn't need to be in there. But then, of course, you know, like I grew up studying like classical music. And I still, to this day, I mean, I love classical music more than I ever have. Mm-hmm. And I'm listening to more long form yeah. kind of pieces, like movements of pieces. And it's just, you know, we so quickly like think of things in a binary fashion. And one is you either like this or you don't at best, or at worst, one of these things is good and one of the other is bad. But I see the beauty in both of them for sure.
Well, and I think that's a more eloquent way of trying to say what I was saying a second ago. I think, you know, my encouragement to any of us that do the creative thing and are, you know, putting together bodies of work or whatever is that, and it's evidenced, you know, in me with this Paul McCartney thing is like, I didn't really grow up on the Beatles. My dad had Rubber Soul and that's, you know, we listened to that, but that's all I knew them because to be a human is to know, even by osmosis,
right.
you know, to know the Beatles, but definitely didn't know his solo stuff very well, other than the stuff everybody knows or Wings or whatever. But it's interesting that you can go back and enjoy these where maybe before you didn't. You know, that's another thing I think mm-hmm. is so cool about what we all do is it's not just binary. It's not just a one chance to bypass something. Like that's what I love about doing this is like, I just want to put it out there and trust God with the rest of it. Like, it's yeah. not my job to it to some degree it is to exploit it, but not really. It's like, I want to be right. responsible with my
so
gifts.
Much.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what's so exciting me about music, about, you know, anything that's recorded, you know, be it in written form or audio, but it always has a chance to be enjoyed, to be interacted with. And I think that's what's so fun about it that keeps me sometimes from the dark nights of the soul where I'm like, you know, spiraling because it's yeah. not working like I want it to, but mm-hmm. to go, you just never know if some kid, you know, in Michigan 10 years from now happens upon John McLaughlin, never heard of John before, and just does like this huge deep dive on the whole catalog mm-hmm. and is like, oh my God, how did I never know about this guy, and inspires his music or his life yeah. or whatever. And so I think that's one of the things that's so exciting about it. That's hard to keep yeah. for me discipline around and how I think about it, which is to go,
that's cool.
It's not just now. It's not just temporal. It's not binary. It's a kind of ever living thing that I'm creating that could have a million lives that I never even know about. You know, I'll tell you the other thing that's crazy too with what we do. I was talking to a friend about this the other day, but when you think about your friends and your kids or whatever, that, you know, what we will have created will be around long after we will. And mm-hmm. that someday my oldest son, when he's 70, could go, you don't want to listen to my dad's second record again. You know, like that's crazy to me.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really powerful.
It's like a little love letter to them.
It's exactly right. Yeah. It's exactly right. And that's a powerful thing. I don't think about that a lot. And I think like, and then if, you know, who knows what music and the interaction with music will be like 100 years from now, my great grandkids could be doing that. And I think, you know, that's a really powerful thought. I think one to legacy and the way we work and what we're trying to create and being accountable to knowing that people will interact with it. So we want to be responsible. But I think too, just knowing it's just fun to get stuff out. That's one more touch point for people to get to interact with you as a person that either is alive or was at one point, you know, it's a pretty powerful thought.
I just need people to find me now. Right? I don't want them to find me 10 years from now when I've already had to go back to Costco. You know what I'm saying?
I thought you were about to say college.
I just or college, whichever one.
Costco is a college of sorts, you know?
It is. You know, there's
a lot to learn there. That's for
sure. There's a lot to learn.
Costco is the only place, you know, you guys are doing Urban Outfitters. It's the only place I like to shop. And the reason is I can't try on clothes there. I just have to buy them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you're in a warehouse.
Yeah,
you're
like,
right.
Sorry, honey.
You just gotta be like, I think I'm a large today because this is what we're getting. That's what's on sale.
Have you ever this happened to me. This is why these Geico commercials are genius. Like, as grown men now, have y'all ever just looked up when you're in Costco? This happens to me a lot now. Like, I'll be in Kroger or I'll be in some, you know, large store, and I will literally do that thing where I look up and I'm like, this is a humongous room. Like, I literally was at Costco like a couple months ago, and I literally looked up and was like, look at the size of this building. Right. Like, who built this build? Like, I was like, oh, this is, I am the guy they're making fun of in those commercials.
How many parking spaces did they have to
get? That's exactly.
What
that's
an
exactly,
architectural marvel this rectangle box is.
I mean, like, what's the overhead?
You're talking about it's that same energy. In the wintertime? What's the monthly on that?
That's exactly what I mean.
No, like, I say that all the time. I'd be like, if I'm in a restaurant and the burger's expensive, I'll go, yeah, but can you imagine what the rent is here? That's why this burger's $12. Like, that's an old man. That is an old man's
thing. It is.
No kid would ever be like, I wonder what the rent is here at Burger Republic.
Yeah.
That's great. Hey, and speaking of becoming again our parents, guys, Dadville, wonderful podcast. You guys
That was a fantastic segue.
That was a really good segue.
How do you do it? I didn't see it coming.
Hey, this is what you get at episode 200. I mean, like,
gosh, you just done it.
Honed it down to a point.
That's right. But no, I mean, seriously, man, just love it. Love what you bring. Really appreciate your vulnerability because it's fun. And you know, this is going way back. When I was a youth pastor for like 15 years, I was remembering the other night, the first night I had the kids. I was like, guys, the most fun thing, I'm going to take you all over the country, all over the world. We're going to have a great time. The most fun thing that's ever going to happen is like, be real with one another and with Jesus. Like, it's going to be a blast. And I feel like you guys bring this, hey, it is so much fun to not hide. It is so much fun to, you know, now I'm quoting some of your the things you say to yourself for who I am when I'm real, all those things. Like, I'm quoting your albums a little bit, but that sort of concept of allowing dads, especially, like, there is a huge, and I know you know this, but allowing dads, and we said this when I was on your show a little bit, like, I'm shocked how out of control I feel as a dad after being with thousands of kids for years and years. And all the cliches feel like that they're chasing me, because I don't normally ascribe to cliches, but like, oh, wow, this is true. Like, this is way harder. And any dad out there who does have it together, I'm super suspicious of him. I'm like, yeah, what are you faking? You know?
Oh, yeah.
So that just like feeling that somebody's out there going, hey, this is what it's like. And you're not just giving advice. You're not just giving like, hey, this is how you do it. Like, you're going, hey, how do we do this? You know, and that was one of my questions to you, like, from the show, and it's a really broad question, but I mean, you know, you're pretty far into this now. You know, what are kind of your general impressions of, you know, I've really taken away X in wisdom or this, I mean, you don't have to be tips and things like that, but just what has it done to affect you truly on your journey? Talking to so many people and garnering so many stories and so many different perspectives. Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think a thought that I have that is kind of a recurring thought as we've been doing this for about a year and a half or so is that it's like, it's kind of what you've kind of outlined. It's like, you know, for the parents out there who care, which hopefully it's, you know, all of us, this is the thing you care about on this earth probably more than anything else is your kids. And I think that dads, especially guys, especially, have a hard time expressing that for whatever reason. You know what I mean? Like, culturally, whatever. It's just not as easy for us to be vulnerable with each other. And so I think I love that. I mean, that's what I get out of it. And I love that we are, in some small way, Dave and I are doing our part to say to all the guys out there, like, hey, we're talking about this stuff. Like, it's okay for me to say how, you know, scared I am about X, Y, and Z with my kids, or how I'm failing in these ways, or like, these are the things that I daily think about. Like, it's actually helpful for me with our guests. And we have, you know, a range of like musician friends on to like more expert kind of, you know, counselors and stuff like that, for me to actually just kind of like voice like the things that keep me up at night, the things that I'm laying in bed at night thinking like, am I doing this wrong? To kind of like keep that in the forefront of my mind, you know, and on my tongue, is so helpful for me. And I mean, I would say the thing that I think about probably the most in terms of like what I've tangibly learned is, and this is one of many things, but I have realized, I think it was Stephen James that we had on that pointed out like, hey, the thing that you're worried about with your kid, 9 times out of 10, that's probably your own issue that you're putting on your kid's behavior. Like, it was a specific situation that I was talking about where one of my kids wasn't playing with other kids, you know, and I was in this meeting with all the dads and I'm like, ah, is she making friends? And he's like, your daughter's fine. Like, she's out there playing with leaves, you know, she's taking the petal right off of a flower, you know, as we say.
That kid's got talent.
She's got talent. She's got it, you know.
And for an 18-year-old is especially impressive.
Right. You know. Without a weed eater. This is just
no weed. Well, she had a weed eater.
Don't use your teeth, sweetie, but she doesn't listen.
So
weed eater with no gas. Just swinging it.
Just swing it. Yeah, but that's, I think about that all the time. And that's just, that's one on a long list of things that I've learned from guests and just from Dave and I just talking about stuff as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, I mean, really the reason that we wanted to do it was because we really do talk about this stuff with our friends a lot. Like, my friends that are dads, we talk about our kids a lot. And I don't know if that's normal or, unusual, but it just felt like this would be cool to do with other people. And like John said, I mean, they're probably like, if we really, we actually have done this every now and then, we'll sit and kind of go, okay, what are the things we feel like we've learned? But there are a ton, but not just are there a lot of them, but they really have changed how I think about my kids and how I parent, which is, you know, as you guys know, doing a podcast is really fun and can be totally, you know, trivial in a wonderful way, just like talking about things and having a good time. But I don't think I really, I think I underestimated how much it was going to have an effect on me. Like, these pieces of wisdom, these pearls that sort of get passed down in conversation, with any of our guests, you know, like, everybody has something to say that's really profound, you know? And so, it's really cool how much I will those things become new things for me. Like, they get stuck into my circuitry and it becomes how I think about life, you know? And so that's something I think has been really, especially fun, is kind of realizing like, man, I just thought this would be a really fun thing to do with John and have guests on and, you know, laugh and hear some great stories and some serious stuff, whatever. And I think in retrospect, I'm like, man, I really did not know how much people are going to say things that like drastically changed how I think, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really fun that way. And you know, I mean, this is kind of the cheesy thing to say, but it's true. I just think dads really matter, man. They really, 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 really matter. And I think, you know, John and I think are especially proud of knowing that we're trying to add to that conversation. You know, we're trying to kind of fly that banner as much as we can, that, you know, it's like that Brian Regan bit about dads. Like, he gets caught in the, you know, there's always commercials with like, my idiot husband, and he's back in the shade. It's like, I can't get out of the shade, you know, which is funny. You know, it's like Modern Family,
everybody loves Raymond. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But, and there's truth to that. And I think that's why it's so funny. But I think at the same time, you know, the gift of being a parent and being a dad, namely for our example, is it's amazing the potency it has and how much it matters. And so I think for us, it's something we get excited about, you know, kind of banging that drum over and over. And I think it's encouraging to see people really resonate with it. You know, you see these dads that kind of go, this is a safe place for me to go and experience that, because maybe it's not something in their normal lives that they get to do a lot or whatever. So it's cool.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, you're normalizing a lot of good conversations.
Yes, there you go.
Yeah, that's really good. You guys are, it needs to be something we're trying to, and even in the church world, normalizing words like, and we're talking about on another podcast episode, words like brokenness, you know, there's a lot of like eye roll to that from a lot of people because it sounds like, oh, well, hey, we all got issues, all got problems, you know, quit whining. And there's a truth to that. Like, how do you live? And I was thinking of that scripture about Paul said, you know, his strength is made perfect in my weakness. And I hear that, guys. I don't hear that verse at all. It's been used so many times in everything I've ever done. And what he's really saying, you could just interchange the words like, hey, I boast in my brokenness is what he's saying. And that if you bring it and normalize that into sort of the modern context of how we're trying to approach and don't just, you know, gloss over the ancient texts that we have constantly heard, you know, things get repeated so much, they stop meaning something to you. And so coming to that place of going, look, what does this really mean? And I think anytime somebody is saying, hey, look, we're not controlled or we're not losing because of the weakness. We're winning. We had this opportunity to win because of the right relationships with God and with others around us. But in the middle of that, there's this beauty that comes out because I'm willing to acknowledge that I need something. And I think saying that I need something and hear you say, yeah, I didn't know I'd be enriched by so many people adding things to me. I mean, that's beautiful. And I think that's our mission, you know, as well. I mean, you know, I don't think Johnny has a mission, actually. I think he's just,
no, I
talked
gave it
into
up.
This a while ago. And he's just,
but I'm off mission and I'm off my notes, honestly.
Off mission.
Yeah. No, I do. I think
that's Johnny W.
No, I think vulnerability is huge and it's a big part of what comedy is all about, honestly, if you're doing it right, because it's like in any art, it's like you grow up trying to hide all your weaknesses from everybody because you're afraid like they're not broken like I am. And if I show them what I really am, they won't appreciate me or they won't care about me. And then you start doing this job. I remember the first time I was on stage and I remember thinking to myself, like I used to have this picture of myself when I was 17, when I had a mullet haircut and like a purple rayon suit. And it was horrifying. And I remember I like tried to get rid of all of those proof that that photo was ever out there. I remember I was on stage one day and I was thinking to myself, I wish I could find a copy of that photo. It would be a funny thing to put on the screen behind me for this bit. And I knew I'd kind of turned a corner of like the things that I would have hidden in the old days now are like, this is what I need to show because there are people out there that had mullet haircuts and purple suits too. And they need to know that like we're all dealing with insecurities. We're all weirdos. We all have horrible things we wish we could forget in our childhood. It's like the minute you tap into that, that's when you really are making art, you know, and then you're really kind of tapping into who you are and you're becoming more self-aware. And so if you just try to be the cool guy on stage, like audiences don't care for that.
Yeah.
Because they know they're not cool and they're like, what's this guy's deal? Right. Like they want to see that you bleed like them.
Right.
You know.
You know, we interviewed Donald Miller a couple of weeks ago and he had just put out a book where he is talking about all these literary like elements and like different characters and it reminded me of when he was talking about the hero of every story. He's like, any story you take, the hero is always like, I hope I'm not butchering this, but he's like the second weakest, you know, character in the story. It's not like they are like, they're not out there just crushing it the whole time. That's a boring movie. Who would want to see that? There always is struggle, you know, like that's what we want to see. That's the whole reason why everyone's in the theater or, you know, listening to the song or whatever. There's got to be some sort of like vulnerability there that is the thing that we just immediately connect on, you know. And it's just interesting that it's so prevalent in art, like so prevalent, but it just we can't translate it over to just everyday life. There's those masks just immediately come up.
You're right. Yeah. In art, we can see it. But then when we live our everyday lives, we still think we need to be the hero of our own story.
Always. Yeah.
Always. We have to put up a mask. We have to be like, we have to be a superhero.
Well, you put it into ministry terms in our world. I mean, the Mars Hill story that everyone's talking about. I have seen in my own life, and I'm a third generation pastor, I have not seen someone quite as maybe gifted and as intelligent as Mark Driscoll. But I have met hundreds, if not thousands, of pastors that would have had the same outcome if they had as much giftedness and intelligence.
Yeah.
Because they needed to be the hero.
Yeah.
And they were told that. And I'm not dogging the guy. I'm telling you, like in ministry, you're told, no one tells you to do that, but there's wrote a book once.
It's reinforced.
And we talked about the deal. Hey, listen, I'm going to be the smarter one, the more spiritual one. I want to have all the answers. And you're going to just want to get through your week. And you show up on Sunday and I'm going to spend my time prepping. I'm going to be funny or intelligent or thoughtful. Or I'm going to well-read, whatever it's going to be. Or I'm going to condemn you and scream at you, whichever one you want, depending on the type of church you like. You show up, you pay your tithe. I get a paycheck and we'll just keep telling each other we're doing what Jesus wants. And like that deal, when you, people don't like it. I have discovered we've become a place where we're way more open about, hey, guys, we're shepherding one another. And I just happen to get, I just happen to be the one who does this vocationally, but we're shepherding one another. And you start, you know, I was on a call this morning with someone like, look, I'm going to come into this meeting with you guys, but you really don't need me. I'm just there to support, you know, and to help. When in the old days, I would have been like, look, I got 1,000 ways I can fix this right now. And it feeds that, that, like you said, Johnny said, that, that sort of hero narrative within me, that you just really can't keep up with. It never actually works out. You can build, you can gain followers, if you will. That's really what a lot of church was for me for years. You're gaining followers, but you're not really making disciples. You know, you're just getting people to follow where you go, as opposed to them knowing where to go. It's just an interesting, I mean, getting out of that mindset. I found at least church people, like you said, doesn't translate from art very well. A lot of church people don't want it. They're like, man, just let me show up and tell me what to do. Like, stop all this where we're gonna
give me a life hack.
Yeah, give me a life hack.
Well, I think the equivalent in our world is you want celebrities. You don't want. Mm-hmm. I told a friend of mine yesterday at lunch, we were talking about this, and I said, you know, we as a society, we're idol makers. And so in our world, in our music world, the version of that is like, if you're really good, what society is going to do is they're going to get you and they're going to put you over here. Like if you're really good at what you do, and this is in any industry, but in ours, that's all I know. So, man, this guy's really good. Now, thank you for being amazing. And now you're over here because I don't want you around us. I want you to be special. I want you to be like this iteration of God that's way down here, but you're still a reflection of it because you're transcendent and your gifts and all this thing. Mm-hmm. So we're going to put you over here because if you're like us, I don't know how to deal with that. I need something I can look to that's bigger than me, that's better than me, that's kind of, and I told a group of young artists this one time, I said, you know, if you're really good at what you do and you have success, people are going to put you over here. And not only are they going to put you over there, but they're going to build a wall around you that you have to get up every day and knock down because that's where you're powerful is and how you're similar, not in how you're different. But there's going to be a part of your brain that's going to go, no, but it's really cool to be different because that means you're special. And, you know, the insecurity and the sin in all of us. And so I think that the weird thing about that, to your point, it happens in the church. I mean, you know, I'm a pastor's kid too, and you see this a lot, but it's really humbling when you realize how much the people around us that really are good at things, we actually don't want them to be like us or be around us. We want them to be separate. We want them to be something we can idolize and look at. Because the minute we see that they're fallen and they do, it's a bummer. It's like, well, no, I need you to be Jesus, and then it sort of kills the paradigm. So it's an interesting struggle to have to walk through whatever the context is realizing like we as people really do have this thing that we do where we're like, we need you to be different. And I think as you create and with us, you know, the four of us who are creators, you know, that's always the hardest thing is because the nature of what we do really is benevolent at its best. Like we want to give, we want to speak life into, we want to connect, we want to commune around what we've been given to do, like our giftings. But the problem is in different industries, you get the exact opposite when you're good at it. You get pushed out, you get set apart. And I think scary, you know, like we see in the Bible so much, but you look at King David, whoever the examples are, like, you're also going to be tempted to relish in that and celebrate it and, you know, get the good, you know, extract all the cool things from that about how you get to be the cool guy or girl, whatever. But I think as creators, the best we can ever be is to be communal and benevolent with the giftings that and service oriented. You know, we're trying to make people feel good or sing along or have a place to go when they're sad or learn about racism in a book, you know, whatever it is to go, this is my chance to serve you and to help the common good. But I think there's always that other momentum that the world brings that we just naturally do as humans, which is to go like, no, I don't want you to be around me. It's weird, but I want you to be someone that's like over there doing your thing, you know?
Well, it's hard not to have someone set their heart on something, I think that's a key phrase from scripture. If you set your heart on something, yeah, if you could set it over there and then, like you said, put your hope on it. I was thinking about the scripture's weird. It says, if riches increase, do not set your heart on them. Hmm. So it's like, it's kind of circumstantial. It's not saying riches are good or riches are bad. It's just saying, look, and I don't think riches is just money, certainly not in ancient times. But, you know, if success increases, that can be good. Make sure you don't set your heart on it. I even think about Jesus sending the disciples out to do miracles and they came back and he said, hey, that's great. Make sure you keep rejoicing in the right things.
Yeah.
Like, rejoice in this relationship I have, that your names are written in the right place and that I've redeemed you. And I think that's that constant daily struggle, especially as creatives, is not to set my heart on the thing my heart is so involved in. I have to like separate and bring back and not get other people to realize whether it's recovery or the Enneagram or anything that we're using, that these are just tools and you can make them into your idols or into your little gods that you think will change the way that you see the world and live, but only actually God can do that. So therefore, we're just going to use these tools to lead you to the one who can, or show you better places of your own self where you can invite him into those places. So,
well, I think it's anything that we can interact with is always going to get idolized. Like, right. I think that's the thing about Christendom that is so tricky, is yeah. we're dealing with a God you can't see, right. you can't touch.
I mean, ultimately, so, we just want something that we can figure out.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, that we can interact with. And so I think that's the great bait and switch in a wonderful way of Christendom. It's the thing where God's like, no, faith matters here, because you really got to believe this, because if you believe it, you're going to act in a way that causes you to pray, causes you to read the Bible, it causes you to commune together, to worship together. And I think it's just hard to do that, man. It's hard to pray. It's hard to read your Bible. It's hard to get still. It's hard to be with people and be vulnerable. And so we're always going to go for that iteration that we can get close to that feels like that, mm-hmm. that gives us the thing without us having to do the faith work. You know? So it's always like, I just think that's some of God's genius. These are the things I get older. I'm just like, God, you little tricky. Okay. And in such a wonderful way, I'm like, I just love that he's like, no, I can't be like that. Because if it's like that, then you're not going to do it. Like, you have to. Mm-hmm. You got to learn how to pray. You got to learn how to be still. You got to learn how to read. You got to, you know, and it's like, but I don't want to.
We talk about that a lot about how, like, this generation and John and our generation before it, the idea of mystery, it started to lose its luster to us. Like, we figured out the internet. We can Google things. We know everything. Yeah. And so it's hard for us to, like, abide that with God. We're just like, yeah, but I want to know all the, we want the listicle of God. We want the life hack of God. Mm. And God's like, no, there's a lot that you couldn't even handle it if I told you.
That's right.
And so, but we're so put out with that more than we ever have been before. Yeah. We don't, yeah. We're irritated by it.
I saw the church's heads explode when I was speaking Sunday. Johnny, I don't think you were there, because I think you're a sinner, but
yeah,
it's something. There's some reason. Sin. That was one of the reasons. And I was like, hey, regardless of your thoughts on, you know, creationism, literal 6-day, all these things, hey guys, if God's eternal, you know, he was doing something 500 million years ago, right? 500 billion years ago.
What?
And they were like, but you know what? He didn't tell us what it was.
Yeah.
And all we know is, and the whole point is that all we know is he was loving the Son. But that's the one thing we're very aware that he was doing. That's the nature of the Father. But like the idea that we don't know. And it's like, what the Bible tells us everything. Well, no, the Bible does not. Right. Everything the Bible says to us is true, but it's not like an exhaustive textbook.
Yeah.
And it's not Google. Like, you know, it's not meant to be so searchable that all the mysteries of the universe. And I think we've sold that to modern Christians.
Weird. It's like God's the parent.
It's like, you know,
God's the parent, like that. Cause my mom told me this. I remember having a conversation with my mom when I was a teenager, and she was showing me like old photos from her high school yearbook or something. And it was blew my mind to see my mom as a teenager. And she looked at me and she said, you think my life began when you were born, don't you?
Mm.
And I'd never thought of it in that way, but that's what we're doing with God. We're like, God exists when I thought of him, when I think that the earth was created. That's when God came of use to me. And so now this is the box that I put him in, you know?
Right.
But. Well, guys, man, thank you so much for the time you gave us today. Tell us, what do you want our listeners and our viewers, where can they find you? Tell me about your current projects you'd like for them to go check out. I mean, if you want right now, all that stuff about your heart, put it aside. And just to sell
Please,
products.
Let's get the 800 number down there.
Well, Why doesn't Dadville have an 800 number, Dave?
It should.
Nobody would call.
My mom would
toll free, you guys.
It would be you and me calling each other.
That'd be great. That's so
hello? Great. Oh, John, no, it's me, Dave. Oh, it's you. Hey, what's up? Hey, can I borrow your mower? Yeah, come on.
Yeah.
So I just put out a new record. It's called All the Things I Say to Myself.
It's really good.
Dave and I co-wrote a couple songs on there.
Those are the two songs I didn't like. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. You emailed me and asked for a version without those songs.
You should collaborate less.
John actually has moved his beef from Just Give It Time to those songs. Now he's
that energy's
got to
go somewhere. So. So I just put that out, and for me, it's Dadville and that new record. Dave's got some stuff that he's been working on. Are you allowed to say what you're working on?
Are you allowed to talk
about it? I'm running for Senate.
That is amazing.
Yep. But the Star Wars Senate. It's me and Palpatine.
That's different.
It's going to be a tough one. I'm doing, this has been really fun. Boy, talk about kind of a cathartic thing. I was telling John about this the other day, but I'm doing kind of like a retrospective acoustic greatest hits album. Technically you need hits, but hits means a lot of things.
Who says?
It means a lot of things. Songs people have listened to is one of the things that I sort of refer to as a hit. But I'm almost done with that. Super excited about that. And that was one of those I think it informed even this conversation, because sitting in the studio re-recording a bunch of them was just really sweet. Like I didn't expect to be so moved by remembering how much I love these songs. And I think especially, again, in retrospect going, gosh, I built a career on these things, were the sturdy bricks that were the first to sort of get laid down, and they're still, and I'm, praise the Lord, I still am proud of them. Cause I know, that's not always the case, So putting that out, this may be the first time I've announced that. So congrats, guys.
You guys get the
200.
There you go. Doing that.
Sturdy
then,
Bricks was the name of our band, by the way.
We were the Sturdy Bricks.
Sturdy Bricks.
Give it up.
I assume that was funk.
Yeah.
Classical, actually.
Okay, that's fair.
Next time.
And then like John said, doing lots of Dadville stuff, and then that acoustic thing is kind of the big thing. We're doing some, I can't announce yet what we're doing. We're doing like a fun little live experience thing around that we'll be announcing here soon. But that's been really fun. It's been a blast to kind of be remembering and sort of re-releasing those songs. John and I have laughed. I don't know. This is one of the things that's quirky about being a creative that does kind of get pretty hysterical. It's like, a lot of these songs I released, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And man, like reference, because I don't really drive around listening to my old music, and I've had to reference the songs because I'm just remembering, like, I need to make sure, because the melodies have morphed and how I play them now has changed a lot. And so I'll pull up the old songs and listen, and I'm like, oh my God, this is the worst vocal in the history of time. And so it's been really, John and I were laughing about that. Look at John shaking his head.
Sorry. I mean, it's... I can't. So I just did a thing where I played six of my albums in six shows, all in one venue, all in one weekend with my band. And I didn't reference songs. I can't go back and listen to them. I'll just be like, at rehearsal, my band will tell me what that, like, oh, we used to go to this. Oh, right. I haven't listened to that record in 11 years,
Yeah.
And even now, like, we multicam... filmed everything. We have like good audio, and the guys in the band we're all texting each other, and they're like, oh, it sounds great. Like, they send me the links. I'm like, guys, I'm never going to watch this. I don't want to see it.
Nope.
I hope it looks great, but I will not watch it. I just can't do it.
That has been one of the things that I didn't see coming. For as much as I've been grateful sitting in the studio, remember these songs, sitting in my studio here, even singing them. Man, I'll pull up. I'm like, how did that second part of that melody? Oh my gosh. Oh, stop. I don't want to listen to this anymore. Okay. We'll just
Why
remember
didn't
that.
Someone tell me to open my mouth. Can
gosh,
I sing?
Man alive. Man alive.
Anyway.
Well, thank you.
But guys, check out some of our early stuff. It sounds great.
These are great sales pitches.
That's so true.
No, it's awesome. Hey, yeah, for real, guys, go and check them out, man. Go subscribe to Dadville. go anywhere you get music and listen to these incredible albums, and stuff's coming. We're very excited for, and it also, you can also check out our podcast. If you haven't yet, if you're just listening to audio and you haven't gone to the YouTube page yet, go to talkaboutthatpodcast.com. Right, Johnny? And what else?
That's
can
right.
Find there?
Oh, they can find the Patreon link. If you want to kick in a few shekels, if you feel so led, stretch you your hands towards the screen, won't you?
Come on.
If not, we know it's a hard time for people, but not for a lot of you. Some of you really flourished during the pandemic. We expect more of you. You know who you are, and let's pitch in, won't we? Like the litter can says. anyway, so you can do that. You can find all the archived episodes. 200, guys, to binge. Jeez, for all your amazing binging needs.
Congrats. Guys, I feel honored that we're on your 200th episode.
Yeah, it's completely accidental, but.
Before we sign off, can I be the podcaster guy and ask y'all what you each get three? What were the three most memorable moments
of the podcast?
200? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I have three. It has been fun though, because I didn't know what I thought it would be. And one thing I thought would happen was we'd run out of stories.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, if we don't do a ton of research, we're going to run out of stories and we're going to tell the same story, you know, 10 times in 10 episodes or something. And it really hasn't happened. I don't know why, but we have a lot of fun doing it. And I'm grateful for that. That's really why we started doing it. It's just like you guys. We were already having these kind of conversations with each other. And we're like, and then we had another friend who said, you guys should be taping these. And so we just started doing it. And and so here we are. And it's changed the world. In no way whatsoever. But
yeah, I get to hang out with my best friend every week, and that's cool. And then there's something I'm archiving also our memories, because there's not a story we haven't told.
Oh, that's true. That is interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'll go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there is something with that, because like my brother listens and we're close, but he'll listen and I can tell he's getting like a side of my personality that he might not otherwise get. Yeah. And my wife listens and she'll be like, you told this story today. And it's like, she's seeing this side of the prism of me that only like John gets to see, really. Uh-huh. Cause I'm just being vulnerable with John. And you kind of forget that the tape is rolling. And so you go, oh wow. Yeah. I'm saying those things. And then, so other people in your life get to see the whole, you. So yeah, there's this 200 hours of me like saved in a time capsule of like, this is the, like, whatever you think about me, like it's the real me. So I think that's probably good.
Yep.
Well, and again, and since you told us to say three apiece, this is all your fault, Dave, that we're going long. But I think for me, one of the reasons I started the podcast is 15 years in youth ministry. There's a whole lot of stuff I wish I would have said to the kids. Sure. And I know that the two other things I do in life, they don't do. They don't listen to sermons and they don't read books. And so one of the reasons I started this was there's a lot of repenting, a lot of like openness about, hey, I wish I would have grounded them more in the love of God than the love of Pastor John. All good intentions, you know, but I didn't have a central gospel sort of center that was given to me yet, that I'm growing into. And so this has been sort of a lifeline. So when one of my former students who's 30 now or whatever with kids reaches out and says, oh yeah, hey, I listen to that. That's a pretty big deal to me. It's a little redemptive.
Dave, it's like if you could go back and fix that bad vocal.
That's what John's doing. I'm fixing.
He's
bad
going
vocals.
Back and he's throwing auto tune on his old sermons.
Listen, you laugh, but that's what this record for me is as much anything. It's like, no, this is what this should have sounded like.
Yeah, that's great.
Oh, it's fun. It's fun. Well, guys,
well, congrats,
thank you so
guys.
Much. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah,
thank you for having us on.
Thanks for
really
joining
fun.
Us. It's great to meet you guys in person or this is as close to in person as we get in these dark times.
It counts in this time.
Yeah. No, thank you guys for giving the time. And hey, thanks all of you who listened to us this week. And as always, we'll see you next week on
Talk About That.
I'm Dr. Lauren DeVille, a practicing naturopathic physician in Tucson, Arizona. In my podcast, Christian Natural Health, my guests and I discuss topics ranging from nutrition, sleep, hormone balancing, and exercise to specific health concerns like hair loss, anxiety, and hypothyroidism. I'll also interweave biblical principles as they apply throughout the podcast, because true health is body, mind, and spirit. Listen to Christian Natural Health for free at lifeaudio.com or on your favorite podcast platform.